But never mind. So for this evening's talk, you're all ready to go?
Go.
Good. No pause. One of the subjects which I talked about over in Bodhinyana during the rains retreat, and not only just to the monks but also to retreats which happened over there, was about how it seems to be in a modern age, maybe the last year, many more people, I may be wrong here, are becoming more fearful. There's more negativity either in the politics, in the economy, or in the relationships, or in the environment, or just basically in the world. And how we can recognize the danger of fear and transcend it, get beyond it, and have a beautiful life. It is true that if anybody watches news or reads newspapers or talks, it's weird that when you talk on a table with your friends and having a cup of coffee or whatever, it's amazing how many people talk of negative things. Somehow or other, that negativity and fear has a more sense of attractiveness to people. When we start to think of all the things which might go wrong, all the dangers which might be happening, especially last week when it was Halloween's night, why can't people have a bit more fun? Because when you have fun and joy, it's the antidote to anxiety. Anxiety is looking at the future and imagining all the things which might go wrong. Where fun is actually looking at even the present or the future and realizing that we can still have joy with it, no matter what happens. It's amazing just how our society even does encourage us to be afraid. And they encourage to be afraid, telling all the things which might go wrong. Be careful. Something might go wrong. The economy. The North Korea. The new government of this or whatever. COVID. That came very clear in our monastery when I was teaching over in Jhana Grove. In Jhana Grove, there were 60 monks in. I would always have lunch over in Bodhinyana Monastery, and many of the Anagarikas or monks would come over to listen to the talks. But in Jhana Grove, I don't think anyone got COVID. Well, over in the monastery, many monks got COVID. I wondered why. And a lot of the reason why was a few monks were very afraid of COVID. And honestly, that fear, I think, was what differentiated the meditators at Jhana Grove with those monks in Bodhinyana Monastery. And I never got COVID. Of all the monks who should have got COVID, I think I was meeting the most people, talking to the most people, not wearing a mask. Never did. Be careful of fear. It's one thing which I don't know how many people like English language, but one of my favorite authors, because he was weird, was Edgar Allan Poe. I don't know if you know that author, Edgar Allan Poe. Now, he had this really weird mind of imagining the pit and the pendulum, where this poor guy was strapped to this piece of wood and the pendulum, this big razor sharp a metal blade would swing backwards and forwards, and every time it would get a millimeter further down, getting closer and closer to his body. And the idea was it would slowly slice him in half. Not very nice, was it? Why do people like going to horror movies? Why do people like looking at the pictures of... I notice even that the monks... There was some Thai monks who was visiting UK some years ago. And we took them to Warwick Cathedral. Not Warwick Cathedral, Warwick Castle. They'd never seen a castle before. And you know the place they wanted to go? To go and see the underground, the torture chambers. And I remember as a kid doing that, when he went to Madame Tussauds Gallery in London, wanted to see the torture. What are you doing that for? That's disgusting, what people used to do to each other down there. But why is it that that negativity tends to give some excitement, pleasure to human beings? Why is it that thinking all the things which could go bad causes, you know, so much attraction for the mind to think like that? And that eventually leads to us almost welcoming fear and welcoming the results of fear. Instead of being someone who looks at fear that not only is it an unpleasant state, but it also it tends to bring about those things we're afraid of. And this is a common example of that. It just came up earlier. When you have a relationship with someone, the relationship is really important to you. And so you're very afraid of what would happen if it breaks down and doesn't work. And so because you're afraid that, you know, your partner might be cheating or your partner doesn't really respect you as much as they should, because of that fear that we have a sense of negativity, we cannot enjoy the moment. I was wondering, what does he mean by that? What does she mean by that? And of course that is self-destructive. When you're in a relationship like that, when people don't trust you and they think that you've done something for reasons you never did, and of course that makes the relationship very tense rather than being at ease. And it ends like breaking up. It doesn't last. Or, you know, when somebody thinks that, you know, you may be really, really sick. And so I've got this theory, I don't know if there's any doctors here, but if you keep on going to see a doctor for something, they'll soon find out something about you which is wrong. They'll give you test after test, and they won't let you get free of the tests until they find something. So that's one of the problems. I remember this story of this, they called him a hypochondriac. And any disease which was fashionable, the in disease of the moment, this guy always had. At least he thought he had it. And so he kept on seeing the doctor. When COVID was coming, the first COVID, he went to see the doctor. And the doctor said, "You haven't got COVID. You're free of COVID. Are you sure?" "Yeah, you sure?" And then it was, instead of the COVID, the Omicron, this B virus, or B, I don't think, whether it's B1, B5 or something. And anyway, every time there was a new variant of COVID, he had to get tested. And then when it became the latest disease virus, monkeypox. If anyone should have monkeypox, it would be me. I'm a monk. Sorry, that's a silly joke. But anyway, this guy went to the doctor and said, "No, I've got monkeypox." I said, "No, you haven't." But this time the doctor was so upset at this guy, it's taking up so much time for the doctor. So the doctor actually shouted at him for the first time, "Look, you're a healthy individual, there's nothing wrong with you, you're fine. Now, don't come and see me anymore until, you know, your leg's fallen off or something. You know, all this hypochondria, you're wasting my time and your time." And has ever that happened to you, a doctor actually shouts at you like that? But anyway, this doctor did, because he just lost his patience with this hypochondriac. And then what happened? The hypochondriac was so stunned. He left the surgery, left the doctor's office, and, you know, he was so stunned that he walked across the road without looking and got hit by a truck and killed. And the doctor heard the sound of the accident, went running out, and he thought, "Oh my goodness, I was too tough on this hypochondriac, and now he's dead." And the doctor had a heart attack and also died. Why are you laughing? That's a tragedy. But anyway, what happened next? was because they died, you know, almost within a minute of each other, they got buried in a cemetery in adjacent graves. And the very first night, when the doctor was in his coffin underground, he heard something was knocking on his coffin. So he opened his coffin lid, and it was a hypochondriac. The hypochondriac said to the doctor, "Doctor, doctor, do you have anything for worms?" So that's an old joke. Anyway, the fear makes us do really stupid things. This is actually true because in Northern Ireland, is there any Northern Irish here, that in a cemetery there, they wanted to, I think in Belfast, they wanted to make sure the Protestants and the Catholics were actually not going to be in any sort of contact together even after they died. So they buried the Protestants. This is an old joke, this is actually real. They buried the Protestants in one side of the cemetery, the Catholics in the other side of the cemetery, and they put this big wall between them, underground. So the worms and the beetles and other bugs, they couldn't go and eat, you know, one of the Catholics and then go and eat one of the Protestants and infect either side. They spent a lot of money doing that. I mean, that just was really crazy that people would do such stuff out of fear. And how much do we human beings, these are extreme examples of fear, and how do we human beings react out of fear and destroying our lives and losing any happiness and hope and joy in what we're doing in our life? So often that people would actually criticize you, and they would, you know, when you were a kid at school, you have to work hard. Hello, nice to see you again. You have to work hard at school. If you fail your exams, then what's going to happen? And I told this story, again a true story, of this kid over in Thailand. He became sort of like an icon, because in Thailand, you'd have to do 4 years of school in the village. This kid, he failed grade one. I'm not sure how that's possible. Maybe he didn't know how to use plasticine or do stick drawings. I'm not quite sure what they do in grade one. To fail a kid in grade one, that's quite an extreme kind of Guinness Book of Records failure. But he didn't stop there. This was an amazing little kid, because he, after the second year in grade one, he failed that too. Third year in grade one, he failed. Three successive years failing in grade one. I mean, that really is just amazing. So they had to kick him out of school. And because they kicked him out of school, that where could he go? He was just too stupid to lead a buffalo. Maybe a buffalo could lead him, but not the other way around. So there's only one place they could take him. That was a Buddhist temple. Now, it's not just all Buddhist monks started off like that. So anyway, they took him to the Buddhist temple in the village. And one thing about, you know, these Buddhist monks in those temples over in Thailand, they were just so patient. And they gave this kid all the time in the world trying to teach him just simple chanting. Because all the monks had to do some sort of chanting. And the trouble is, he just couldn't learn. As I heard it, they tried to teach him just like the Namo Tassa, which we Buddhists like doing. He could get Namo, but then he had to learn the second word, Tassa. And when he started learning the second word, he forgot the first word. So he was had intellectual learning difficulties. So after a year or two in the village temple, they couldn't teach him a thing. So what do you think they did with him? There's only one other option. That is the forest monasteries. That's where we come from. The Wat Bar Forest Monastery. So anyway, they took him to a forest monastery. We don't do that much chanting in the forest monasteries, believe it or not. But this young man, they just taught him how to meditate. Just simple things like watching your breath, be in the present moment, be silent. And that was the easiest thing in the world for him. He didn't have a restless mind. He didn't go thinking of the future and all the things which might go wrong. He didn't start holding in the past. His mind was just so peaceful and so free. And he soon became one of these famous enlightened monks in Thailand. So simple. So if you have like a son or a daughter and they're not doing well at school, sadhu, 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 well done. That may be your future enlightened being for Perth. Don't scold them, don't make them learn. Celebrate who they are. And apparently, that monk, we all have to do some chanting somewhere along the line. And that monk, he learned how to chant. It's weird what he said, by being able to contact his previous lives, not this life, his previous lives, he could chant very well. And that's actually how he learned to chant in this life. Every time he had to do a ceremony, just contact, you know, his previous life and pick up the chanting from there. Maybe you don't understand that, but that's true, that's what happens. But the point was that simple mind had its own benefits. He didn't have to fear failure. There was no failure. He was just different. And when they found out how to celebrate and make use of those differences, it was amazing. That's why, you know, these days, at last, when you see people who are somehow different, intellectually different, who are somehow, you know, not built the same way as most people, then instead of putting them away in some sort of home and thinking they don't exist, just finding out their qualities, celebrating them, making the best use of them. There are people who think in different ways, who see things in different ways. You know, what sometimes people call autism. Is that sort of a debilitating feature? Or is it just that people haven't, most of the majority of the population haven't learned how to accept and deal with it? Why are we afraid of difference? Instead of celebrating that difference, accommodating it, and making better use of it. So it's actually wonderful now, as a monk here in Australia, people know who you are. When I first came here, all those stories, my goodness, why are you dressed as a girl wearing a dress, Ajahn Brahm, people used to say. Why didn't you get a proper job? Now people know who we are, so they never say that anymore. Or just like I remember for the LGBTQIA+ community, I remember just talking with, who was the leader of the Green Party a long time ago? She was giving a speech, and it was one of my proud moments in life. I supported the LGBTQIA+, but I said that you still don't include the monastics, the celibates. So I thought we'd need to get a flow to the next gay pride celebration. Celibates. Monastics. But anyway, I remember just talking to her, and she was actually saying to me that it was really exciting to do the gay pride marches in the old days, simply because you never knew what to expect. Now they're accepted and part of the community. She said it's not so much fun anymore. There's a sense of achievement, but not the sense of excitement of making things better. You know, for her, it was already quite a lot better. But one of the reasons is, why do we fear so much? Why are we afraid? It's amazing when you stand for what you believe in. I mean, there's a gentleman here, where has he gone from? Adelaide University, there he is. He was doing a little survey about bhikkhunis, nuns, about their ordination, fully ordained Buddhist women. And he said, why is there a problem about that? Why are the people afraid? And they are afraid of having Buddhist women as equals to monks. Honestly, I can't understand what the problem is. I've been a monk for a long time now. I've travelled around the world, seen lots of Buddhist nuns, and they're great. Give us more. So because of that, what is the problem? It's fear. Oh, if you do this, that something will go wrong. That's one of the reasons why, to prove it doesn't go wrong, you do it and see what happens. I always liked that idea. And I don't know, I must be some kind of rebel, because I really enjoy just standing up there. And sometimes you do feel afraid, but you're not going to follow that fear. You're going to stand for what you know is right. And that becomes inspiring in our world. Other stuff. I remember one of my heroes in Perth. It's weird having all these different types of heroes. One of them, some years ago I got this medal from John Curtin University, for starting off a really good community here and supporting women. But also that the next year I went to this medal award for Professor Jofi. He was the head of hematology at the time in Charlie Gardner's hospital. And when I went there for his award ceremony, because I won the award a year before, I was so inspired by him. He was a top doctor, had immense academic qualifications, but he noticed something which was wrong in a hospital system, and that was that everybody got the best chemotherapy, radiation therapy, surgery. You know what was missing? The kindness and care. I don't know the last time you've been in a hospital, but do actually people spend time talking with you, caring for you? You may be really sick in the bed and holding your hand. Sometimes people are afraid to hold the hand, they might get sued or catch something. Oh, for goodness sake. That kindness is one of the best parts of therapies. And anyway, this top doctor, he was the one who decided to put aside his scientific credentials and invite, he got a few rooms in that hospital, and he invited Reiki therapy, homeopathy, acupuncture, anything which he said was weird, which hadn't been scientifically, totally, 100% proven. You could get there for free. After you'd come out of the hospital and had some radiation therapy or whatever. Even things like reflexology and foot massage. I remember talking to him, he said the reason he was doing that, at the time there's no real scientific evidence that it was going to help. But just he knew, if you went into a hospital and you were just almost like, unfortunately, people don't have the time to do anything better, treated a bit like a robot, just a client, not a person. But then in this place afterwards, you could be treated like a person. Somebody was being kind to you, just giving you a foot massage. And that kindness is so important. And that kindness was having a huge effect on the recovery rate of those people. People were caring for them, not just giving them a radiation therapy and then moving on to the next person. They had time for you. And that was really important. It took away their fear. The results were that people got much better results. The healing rates improved. And he made that sort of little sacrifice of risking his reputation by doing something which wasn't proven. What happened in the end? So he got a prize for that. I thought, what a wonderful thing that is, that people are willing to stand up and maybe be ridiculed, but you know that this is right and you have no fear of doing it. And that's one of the reasons as why, as a Buddhist monk, you want to do that, keep on doing that, standing up for what you know is right. And even though people might criticize you, I don't think people criticize me enough these days. Life is getting boring. But nevertheless, you can understand what I mean. Don't be a prisoner of fear. Don't be stupid, but nevertheless, just maybe, just even those of you, you know, have maybe been through a relationship and you don't want another relationship because it hurts. I say this to young people, never put your heart in a concrete box. It's true you don't get hurt, but you're not alive either. I told it to someone just a few days ago as well, that this was like one of those dreams I had. It never happened, but I remember dreaming one day when I was a young boy that I got attacked by thugs with knives, and they stabbed me many times. It never happened, but it was like real for me, like a dream. And I remember what happened afterwards, that my mother, as a mother would, seeing, you know, someone you love being attacked like this, you know, with almost like superhuman strength, running out of the little council apartment, council flat we called it, and just attacking those boys, you know, risking her own life. And I don't know what happened next, because what I remember, and it was very clear to me, that it hurt so much being stabbed, that I just went deep inside to a place where I could not be hurt. And like catatonia. And then, just remember, years later, it's a very weird dream. Maybe I'm a weird monk, but I don't mind sharing all those weird dreams and stories with you. I remember just years afterwards, coming out from that catatonia, coming out from that safe place deep within where you didn't feel. And the only reason I did that, because I remember just being in some sort of institution, and there was this super kind nurse who was like playing a song on guitar or something, and that just managed to go deep inside me, past all those protective barriers I'd erected so I couldn't feel, and then just to bring me out into the world again. I remember just sometimes how life can hurt so badly. I must say, it never happened. Sometimes it was so real. But I checked, you know, with my history, my mum and everybody, and that never happened to me. But nevertheless, somehow you could recall that an experience as if it was real. But it gave me a great understanding of what fear can do to you. It can put you so deep inside, you feel it's better not to feel at all, just to hide inside some impenetrable shell. And what overcomes that fear is again the great kindness. It's one of the reasons why even many people who come to this place, I don't know what you've been through in your life, but many people have been very heavily traumatized, you know, through your life, you know, difficulties with relationships, people dying, you're not being treated fairly, or whatever happens in life. And sometimes what do? We hide inside out of fear. We're not living. When you do make yourself vulnerable, you know, how people actually say this is one of the most vulnerable things you can do, to get up on a stage like this and give a talk, not just to a couple of hundred people in the audience here, but through that camera online as well. Sometimes those are supposed to be scary moments. I remember they saying that one of the most scary moments when you go on live TV, and it gets broadcast all over the world. And not only that, if you make a mistake, if something bad happens, look, I just kind of noticed. 30 minutes I've been talking, and all this synovial fluid which was coming out of my nose when I started, it's all stopped now. Sometimes these things are weird. When you don't have any fear, weird things happen. So anyway, just I noticed that all those years that I've been like a monk now, you try not to have any fear no matter what you do. One of those ways of not having fear is not like if you're giving a talk. I learned this years and years ago, that whenever I give a talk, I don't really care what I say. I care, but I don't worry about it. I'm not afraid. That's one of the reasons why, given so many talks, how can you give a talk about a new subject? But very often I've just made subjects up at the last minute. And you know, some of the subjects which you make up at the last minute are the most interesting. If you go through all the types of talks which I've given, now they're all recorded, they're on YouTube somewhere. And some of the talks I've given, some of the ones which I felt were really good, were talks like Buddhism and Bananas. It's a really good talk, Buddhism and Bananas. You should have a look at that one. You know how I started with Buddhism and Bananas? I'm just going off on a tangent here. Buddhism and Bananas. If you remember this simile, that when you eat a banana, you have to peel it first. How do you peel bananas? Do you peel bananas correctly or wrongly? How do you know how to peel a banana? You go to the experts. Who are the experts with bananas? Did you say monks? Monkeys. They're the experts. And if you ever see a monkey peel a banana, they never peel it at the stalk. The banana's got two ends, a stalk end, and the other end is where the little flower was. It's much easier to peel it at the flower end. And that's how monkeys peel it. So next time you have a banana, just do an experiment. Peel it at two bananas, one at one end, one at the other end, and see just how monkeys were so wise. And as I said, I use that simile. If you want to learn something like meditation, who are the experts with meditation? Monks and nuns, yes. So if you want to get the best teachings, go to the experts. We're not only the best teachers, but also we're the cheapest. You go online or to some of these courses, some of these houses, and you find out that it's really expensive. And I can't understand you guys. You get much better teachings here, right down the line, what's real Buddhist. And sometimes, you know, now you just go to some other course somewhere, you have to pay a fortune. I don't know why you do that, but anyway. So that's when the course on Buddhism and bananas. You know, sometimes people, because we don't charge for anything here, we don't charge, but look, you know, we always manage to get by very easily. Where does all that money come from to run this place? And it comes from just because people are kind and generous. And it's wonderful just to see how people relate. When, you know, I give out these things for free, Ajahn Mamadi gives it free, Ajahn Hasapani gives everything for free. We always, you know, do well. That's one of the reasons why. Oh, these old stories. Somebody called up once. I answered the phone in the old days. And they said, I hear you're teaching meditation tonight. I said, yeah, I'm teaching this evening. And he said, how much do you charge? It's a fair question, because sometimes you have to pay a lot of money to practice meditation. And the answer was, don't charge anything. And the answer was from this woman, well, you can't be any good then. And she hung up. It was a nice, funny story, because that means a lot of people, they always feel that if you pay a lot for it, it must be much better. And you challenge that. Don't be afraid for giving things out for free. Don't be afraid of like forgiving somebody you care about and love. It's one of the reasons why, when I was in Singapore once, and the people were asking me, how many times should you forgive Ajahn Brahm when people have really hurt you? How many times? And the answer was, always one more time. In other words, forgiveness is something beautiful. Don't be afraid of it. But people will take advantage of you. No, they won't. When it's real forgiveness, that is kind of respected so greatly by the other people. And sometimes it discombobulates them. How can you forgive someone who's been so mean to you? But you do forgive them. Always one more time. You are training them. Now, I've got to be careful here because I told this story so many years ago, and it's in the first book which I wrote, The Opening the Door of Your Heart. I did get some feedback from that saying, Ajahn Brahm, you shouldn't tell this story because it encourages domestic abuse. I said, no, it doesn't. It's not the purpose of encouraging domestic abuse. It's just to show one other opportunity to heal domestic abuse. And that was, you know, before we had this hall over here, when the Friday night talks were given in the what we call now the community hall, this woman came to see me after the Saturday afternoon meditation. And she came up to me, and she was one of these women. She wasn't young and beautiful, she was like middle-aged and beautiful. I don't mean beautiful because she was like some supermodel, just her face was just like beaming with pure good energy, almost like a saint. And it kind of struck me that sometimes as a monk you see things in other people which maybe other people just don't see. And she said, I just come up here to thank you. And that's always interesting when they say that, because I want to find out why. And they said that she'd been coming to our Buddhist society for 7 years. And the only reason she came to the Buddhist society was not to learn meditation or to learn Buddhism, but just as an escape from her house where her husband was being violent to her, punching her, hitting her. This is one of the reasons I have to be very careful here, because if that happens, please, that's really dangerous. You know, get sort of a policeman or somebody, a counselor, to make sure that you're not going to be in trouble of being traumatized or being hurt and killed. But anyway, this was many years ago. So, and I understand this from her. I learned from her that when you are in an abusive situation, you don't think straight. Sometimes your brain is really confused, and what's obvious afterwards or beforehand, at that time, the mind is just so busy thinking in circles and ovals and all over the place, it doesn't think straightly. But anyway, she said, I've come to thank you. She was in this position of domestic violence. And then over 7 years, she said, she picked up the meditation stool she had been sitting on during the meditation session. See this wooden stool? Said, my husband made this for me and gave it to me for my birthday. And that meant so much to me because 7 years ago, if he made anything like this, it would be to hit me with. That's how bad it was. I said, what did you do? And she said, I followed this little method of never watering the weeds, but watering the flowers. You've heard me say that many times before here. Every time her husband mistreated her, she forgave it. That's not enough. Every time her husband treated her kindly, she smothered him with kisses or other ways of saying that this is the behavior that you should be doing. It took her 7 years. That's an awful long time. She's a bit of a hero for even trying that. But she said, he's such a beautiful man now. And he would come to the temple. I remember him, her taking him to Bodhinyana Monastery so I could see him. What she was saying was true. And she had these two beautiful kids. She'd won her happiness. It was very difficult for her, but at least she changed her husband and has amazing kids. She's one of my heroes, which I've met in my life as a monk. So this is actually not giving in to fear and not always believing what other people say. Sometimes there's other ways, and sometimes you don't have a choice, sometimes in a difficult situation. But nevertheless, there's always many other things which you can do. And don't be afraid of trying them sometimes. It is fear which stops progress and innovation. Fear which says this won't work. It can't work. But there's a sense of courage and inspiration which says, yes, it can. And it does. I always say that in, for example, in universities, I was at big university when I was young. I remember being in a lab and one of the other students in the lab, there was a big bang. He blew up one of the pieces of equipment. Expensive piece of equipment, I forget exactly what it was, but then bang and all the smoke came out. And I thought that he could really get in trouble for that, wasting expensive equipment. But all the lab technicians and the other professors, they said, no, never mind, we'll get another one. Because they wanted to instill the lack of fear when you're experimenting. If we have fear, we never break the boundaries and make progress in science. We never break the boundaries which stop us from making progress in our communities, in our cities, in our ways of governance or whatever it is. That sort of courage is what breaks through. Fear just keeps you in the prison of what you're used to. And that was really why I mentioned a talk on fear when I was teaching a meditation retreat. You know, sometimes when you're meditating, this is big stuff, it's not small stuff. And sometimes when you're meditating, it's incredible, peaceful, blissful states of mind. And a lot of times people are afraid. So I'm going to tell a couple of stories just to really scare you at first, but then realize there's nothing to be afraid of. This is actually in the Buddhist suttas, been known for 2,500 years. There was a monk. He was meditating in the forest. And as he was meditating, he was so still. That when villagers who were looking for mushrooms or something in the forest or other herbs, when they saw him, they saw this monk sitting so still they couldn't see him breathing. And the villagers thought, you know, we can't just leave someone just to die like this. He'd get eaten by the jungle animals. So they decided, they're in the forest anyway, there's lots of dead wood around, to collect some dead logs. It took him a few minutes. Put the monk on top of the dead logs, do some chanting, whatever they could remember, and light the funeral pyre. So they cremated that monk there in the forest. And of course the fire was very hot already, so they thought, no need to hang around. They went home. Next morning, you can imagine how surprised, afraid, when that monk walked into the village for alms round. Not even his robes were scorched, fully alive, no injury at all. If that was you, if there was a big bushfire over in Serpentine, in our monastery, or in Dharmasara, what to do? If you can't run away, cross your legs and meditate. And you'll be safe. so often that sometimes people say, oh, you're crazy, Ajahn Brahm. Yeah, maybe, but crazy is only because people are afraid of facing some of this stuff. Are you afraid of what other people think of you? As I said, even when I gave talks to many people, one of the tricks which I did when I first gave a huge talk over in Singapore, all by myself, there's no B act or no supporting act. It was just Ajahn Brahm at Suntec City. That was the convention center there. About 3,000 or 4,000 people. Well, the first time I gave a really big talk. And I was afraid, not so much of, you know, not giving a good talk, but afraid of also the problems of giving a good talk, becoming too proud and arrogant, thinking you're the best mug in the whole of the world or whatever. And that's also dangerous. So how can you get not really worried what other people think of you? It's pretty simple, because I knew that whatever talk I gave was only because of the teachers which I'd had, especially someone like an Ajahn Chah. So as I was walking to the chair there, lots of flowers everywhere, and with all these people about to listen to me, I thought, I'm not giving this talk. It is Ajahn Chah, my teacher, who's giving the talk. I've just been trained by him, conditioned by him. So I have nothing to worry about. And I didn't. There was no fear at all. Because I had no fear, I gave a really good talk. And I had to go back again, give another one. But if I was at all afraid what I was going to say and how I was going to behave, of course, you become so tense you couldn't do anything. And the last little story about fear is of this man who went to the psychologist. And as he went into the psychologist's office, he said, I've got a big problem. What's your problem, sir? He said, sometimes I'm sure I'm a marquee. You know the marquee, the big tents that which are used for big functions? He said, other times, other days of the week, I'm sure I'm a wigwam. That's, you know, what the indigenous Indians in the US used to live in. Sometimes I think I'm a wigwam, sometimes I think I'm a marquee. And the psychologist thought for a while, this is weird. The psychologist said, I know your problem. You're too tense. Okay. I'm sorry, I've said that joke before here, I know. But anyway, just to make you go away with a happy smile. Okay, so that's a talk on fear. Any questions? Comments, complaints. Eddie, which one is it? Is a complaint, a question, or a comment? Yeah.
Fear and the press, all okay?
I was afraid you were going to say that.
wait.
No, okay, carry on. Oh my goodness.
See, for my analysis, okay, in Buddhist sense, okay, yeah. Fear is caused by, you know, like a phenomena, something happened outside, you know, okay, like press or what, okay, and the mind harps on it, I think, you know, and that if it's something not good, then we have the fear is the feeling, you know, the negative feeling, you know, okay. So a lot of it comes to overcome it, okay, a lot of it comes from our effort to overcome this, okay. And also from the phenomena too, you know, from the press, I see the thing. You know. That's so. It's so. How do I say? The whole system is buggered up, you know. You know that the whole world system.
I can't say that.
So there should be something to do. Sorry. To
carry on.
To, how do I say? Maybe on the control effort of people, a thing. You know,
yeah.
To stop them from doing. How I say? Creating. Fake news, all these things, fear,
yes,
and
yes.
Comes with selling of their weapons. You know, these are the people making the money.
Now you're getting closer.
So you see what I mean? It's a two-way thing out from outside and how you perceive the thing.
All fear is losing something you're very attached to. The more attached you are to it, the more fear you experience. Which is one of the reasons when you do follow a path like Buddhism, your attachments get less and less. Basically, you have nothing to lose anymore.
Yeah, but how many people can do it? Less and less.
You can. Everybody
do it.
Can.
I think maybe I can
it just
do a little
takes
bit
some time.
Thing, but normal people, they can't, you know. They see all these negative
you
things.
You mean I'm not
they,
normal?
They feel disturbed.
Oh, no, please. This is what happens. It's, losing something you think is really essential for you. And after a while, being like a monk, a nun, you've got nothing to lose anymore. Losing your reputation, losing your health, losing your body, whatever. You don't own anything. The less you own, the less fear you have. Anyway, I'll do a couple of these.
Thank you.
I know that I did make a promise to our caretakers, because they have to close up afterwards and they're staying up too late. They're not the young people they used to be last year, the 1 year older. So I'll just do a couple of questions and we'll try and finish at 9:15, is that okay? Okay, I think I did make that promise. What is the immediate antidote to fear at the time that it arises? Sometimes laughter, if you can get a laugh. Other times it is realizing that most fear is just irrational. If you want to, write down every time you were afraid and what you were afraid of losing, and how many times did you actually lose it? You don't. So fear is an exaggeration of the mind. Stay in the present moment, you've got nothing to be afraid of. You're afraid of the future. From Malaysia, how to overcome grief. My mum passed away 4 months ago. I feel sad thinking about her. Despite knowing death is just a natural phenomenon, I still find it hard to let go. But with grief, just change your perception. I've said this many times before. My father died, I was never sad. I never felt grief at his loss. Actually, it wasn't a loss. I never thought of it as a loss. It was a gain. I had him as my father for 16 years and I loved him dearly. How can you feel sad about that? 16 years, a beautiful father. Thank you so much. And the simile which I found to describe my feelings, the end of a great concert. At the end of a great concert, you stand up, you shout, well done, yeah, more, more, more. Sometimes the band plays some more. But you never cry at the end of a great concert. You always feel just so blessed and lucky to have been there at the time. And that was precisely how I felt. I'm not exaggerating. When my father died, it would have been wonderful if you could have been here and seen me as a monk. But those 16 years were magnificent. Well done. Felt like standing up and clapping at his funeral service. But how would people feel if I did that? They'd think I was really weird and crazy. I was afraid then what other people thought of me. These days, Eddie, if you passed away and I went to your funeral, can I stand up, clap and cheer? Well done, Eddie. They think the Buddha Society were coming into a big inheritance or something. I don't know. Question. Hi, Ajahn. Could you give some insight about dealing with feeling disconnected with place and society you're living in? Always feel like you don't belong in a place. You always want to be somewhere else. You can't always want to be somewhere else, because that is just so much suffering. You're always here. People get asking me, am I going to be here next week? I am here next week. But here happens to be London next week. But I'm here. Just you're not here. Not my fault. Don't be disconnected, because you have to be disconnected wherever you happen to be right now. This is one of the ways of overcoming that, is remember Emperor's Three Questions. This was Leo Tolstoy, brilliant teaching. When is the most important time? Yeah, the easy one. Who is the most important person? Did you say Ajahn Brahm? If you did, that was wrong. The most important person is the one right in front of you right now, whoever that happens to be. What's the most important thing to do? It's to care. Such simple but powerful teachings. That connects you straight away with wherever you happen to be, whoever it happens to be. Now's the most important time, the one right in front of you, the most important person in the whole world. Really important. And the only thing to do is to care. If you live your life like that, you'll be enlightened very quickly. Lastly, from Israel. Any advice on how to bring parents closer to the Dhamma? I want to ordain after uni, but I'm afraid of their reaction, as currently they think Buddhism is a cult and don't really understand the importance of the practice in my life. Also, really grateful for all your hard work. A cult? I say that to people. Sometimes if you join the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, a cult, that I have to sign your form. And often, I didn't say that today, but I often say, greetings, welcome to our cult. That's one of the reasons why it's sometimes the monastic's fault. Because our job is actually to get out there and be seen, so people get to know us. I think one of the places which I went to recently was the Albany Temple, Ajahn Mudu's place. And when I went down there, he told me a wonderful story that was, he's really tried very hard, and takes a lot of effort, to connect with the local community. He's in the suburb of Elika, that's to the west of Albany. And so I told him, just, you know, check in with the locals. So whenever there is a Elika community meeting, he usually goes there. Of course, they have beers and stuff, but he's a very good monk, he never has that. But anyway, he was at one of these meetings and they announced it's the AGM of the Elika Progress Association. So they said, well, you have to leave. He said, no, I'm a member. He was actually a registered member there. The Anagarika joined him up. So he said, oh, no, I'm here. And so they said on the AGM that they have to elect the committee for next year. And the president said he's been the president of the Elika Progress Association for as many years as he is allowed. He has to get a new president this year. So the ex-president said, I hereby nominate Venerable Mudu. He was nominated to be the president of the Elika Progress Association. And that's how, you know, he was very friendly with everybody and they really respected him. And then he said, okay, I'll accept the nomination on one condition, and that is that as soon as I'm president, you will allow me to ban beer in the Elika Progress Association Hall. And everyone went quiet. There was silence, he said. And then, almost like unanimously, they all shouted, boo! And so they took away his nomination. So he got away with not having to do any work. But that's, you know, sometimes, you know, how they can see that he's always very friendly and he's welcome down there. And you can see just that's why people realize it's not a cult. It's just a wise organization where people can, you know, he doesn't drink alcohol, doesn't support to drinking alcohol, but he would never criticize anybody who does. If that's what they do over there, fine, but please don't serve me any beer. That's actually how we make, you know, this path of Buddhism not a cult, but it's a kind, friendly group of people. And each one of you the same. Do you feel like you're in a cult? Exactly, that's what cults are like. You never feel you're in one. No, this is the openness there. And during the range retreat, we have all sorts of other people come here to give talks. I don't know who gave the talks last time. We've had Muslims in here, Christians in here, and who else? All sorts of people in here. And I very support that, because at least, you know, you can hear from others and see what they say and how they behave. Okay. Okay, that's all the questions. So what I'm going to do now, we're going to finish off now, and instead of actually coming up to see me here afterwards, I'm going to go to the community reception area. I'm going to sit there, which gives a chance for our caretakers to close this up and not lose too many hours of sleep. Is that okay? Okay. So please don't come up here to ask questions. I'll go to the community reception area. You can ask the questions there. Sadhu.